Okay, so we're live. Welcome to the Magic Minds podcast. I'm Matt Bourke. Today I'm joined by a special guest, Dr. Ger Colran. Ger, what's the crack?
Hiya, Matt. I haven't seen you in so long and you haven't changed a bit.
I give over. I've less hair.
Yeah, you may have less hair, but still you're the same gregarious person I remember. So.
Hopefully that's a good thing. Yeah. Okay, guys, I've asked Ger Colran to come on the show. One, because he's a doctor in immunology.
No, microbiology.
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 Oh, man, I need to do my research a bit better. I always knew you as an immunologist.
No, I just, you remember me as an immunologist because part of the program that I lectured to you here in the Institute of Technology in Tala had an immunological component, and that's why you remember the immunology. But I'm actually a qualified microbiologist for many years, and have been working here as a microbiologist for nearly 20 years.
Right. If I had a researcher, I'd sack him, but that's me, so I don't think I'm going to lose my job today because of that. Right, guys, the reason I've asked Jared to come on the show is because, yes, because of his qualifications. Two, as well, because the influence he had on me when I attended Tala College. You know, he delivered education in such a unique way, humanized, personal, professional, and I just want to tap into that and then also then tap into his professionalism as a microbiologist. So give us a little background here to your story into your profession.
Well, I suppose if we start at the very beginning, I was born in Donegal. I worked, I moved from Donegal to Galway because my family worked in Galway. And then I grew up in Galway, was educated in Galway, went to college in Galway, did my degree in Galway, and then did my doctorate in Galway at the university there. And subsequently, I went on to work for a diagnostics company in the university in Galway, and then later a diagnostics company in County Clare. And one of the things that I suppose influenced me at that stage was I was an academic, but I couldn't find an academic job. It was in the recession of the 80s. And I elected to move into industry at that stage. And while I was in industry, I became fearful of redundancy. And I realized that one of the main motivations in my career was job security. And so I continued to look for a career as an academic, working as a microbiologist, very enthusiastically, I should say, very dedicated in the job as a microbiologist. But I really did yearn for that permanency in terms of work, and an opportunity arose at the Institute of Technology here in Tala, and I remember it clearly, I was the last person to be interviewed for the job on a wet Friday evening, and I remember the candidate before me was sitting in the waiting area telling me how wonderful his academic qualifications were.
Oh,
and
no.
I felt so diminutive and so small, and I said, well, this job, obviously I'm not going to get it. So I was very relaxed when I went into the interview because I realized that the quality of candidates appearing before me were superlative, and that really I was just going to have an enjoyable conversation with the interview panel. And that's what transpired. It was a very enjoyable interview, as I remember, and I was shocked to be offered the job some weeks later. I was quite incredulous that I was offered a job as a lecturer, and it would mean moving from the west of Ireland to the east, to Dublin, and I had to contend with property prices and all that sort of thing. But I got the job here as a microbiologist and we've been working here ever since, creating courses, delivering courses in the unusual way that I deliver courses, I suppose. I sometimes call it lecturing by interpretive dance.
But I'll get to that in a minute.
But I've enjoyed my time here. We have a great team of colleagues working together, and we've created what is probably one of the most successful science courses in an institute of technology in the country. And that's something that I've had a small part to play in, and I really enjoy that. We're now moving into new areas. We're in China. I did some lecturing in China. We were in Malaysia. And we're also now beginning to lecture in company with a lot of pharmaceutical and medical device companies as well.
Absolutely brilliant. It's just interesting you say that about going in for an interview.
Yeah.
You know, you went in relaxed. It wasn't rehearsed.
Absolutely.
There's a lot to be said for that, isn't there? Going in, doing anything, you know, when the barriers are down, you can flow, you can express yourself. It's interesting.
I was giving you a summary there, but in fact, the Institute of Technology wasn't the first institute that I knocked on the door of.
Okay.
I had actually been invited to 7 institutes of technology for interview prior to that.
Wow.
And I always came second in the interview selection process. And I think what made the difference in Talla was the fact that I was so relaxed on that day, that wet evening, as I described, of the interview. And being relaxed when you're going into an interview is so important, because the true person appears before the panel when you're relaxed.
Love it.
And provided that, you know, you're competent and qualified, and your personality shines,
yeah.
You know, that's really important. So, I mean, to your listeners, what I would say, anyone who's listening, who's considering a job application, yes, you have to prepare. Yes, there has to be an element of research done about the employer. And yes, you have to accentuate all your positive characteristics. But you do have to be relaxed. You do have to smile. You do have to come across as a person and not just
a human,
yeah. And not just somebody who has rote learned something.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to develop or show them a signal that you can develop a working relationship with them. Because what I've understood now, being on the other side of the interview table, one of the key questions that goes through the head of an individual who's interviewing is, can I work with this person? And that is a subliminal thought in everyone's mind when you're being interviewed. The people who are interviewing you are wondering, can I work with this person? And the real way to show them that is to show them your pleasant, cooperative, trustworthy nature through your personality.
And there will always be that unconscious bias, from the other person.
Yeah, I think we are human. We tend to have our own anxieties around previous types of people that we may have met, and that can sometimes influence the way we're interviewing. So it's important that
it's not just about the stuff that's coming out on the paper and what they have to tick the box as well. Yeah, well, he said this and he said that. They will be looking. Can I connect with this other human?
Exactly. Can I connect? And do I feel that this person is somebody that I can trust, that I can work with, and that I would have an enjoyable working relationship with? Because that's really important. I think the reason why I'm 20 years in the job that I'm in is not just that I enjoy the job, but the colleagues that I work with, we enjoy each other's work collectively. So that's really important when you consider trying to get a job.
Absolutely. Right, my next question, what you're saying about working together, you've had a huge impact on me going forward as delivering education. I deliver education in the hospital, and as a human being, you took away that kind of academia, and you can have the crack, you can present in a certain way that you can still be professional, you can still be, get the job done, but be very in a human way. Who was your influences that kind of shaped that for you?
Well, that's a really interesting question.
Can
Matt?
I just give an example of why you sang a song to me and you explained aeronautic diseases? I had a little bird.
Zoonotic diseases.
I had a little bird and his name was Enza. Opened up the window and influenza. And that was like flu viruses passed through the air.
Yeah, but also they passed through birds as well.
Yeah.
Because avian flu and so on.
And I've never forgot that.
Yeah, it's just simple things. That was a moment, I suppose, of levity in the lecture. And, it's not in any academic book on influenza by no means, but you have to, first of all, I suppose, connect with your audience. And my audience are adults. They're not kids, people with life experience. I have to develop a rapport with my audience. That means I have to get to know my audience. And I think that's something that I didn't experience at university, because universities are, in some way, they're quite different from institutes of technology, because in a university, you wouldn't get to know your lecturer on a first-name basis. You certainly wouldn't. And they would rarely know the names of most of the people in the class, whereas I would know the names of all the people in my class. And I would get to spend time with those people, particularly any students that have difficulties. They, again, through the energy that I would give off in a lecture and the personality type that I am, students would feel that they can trust me and I can trust them. And that's really important when you're trying to get students to engage in a subject. You have to build trust. You have to connect with them on their level. You have to understand their fears and anxieties about being in college and so on. And you also have to understand that your language as an academic needs to change if you're going to connect with them. And so that's why I introduced those simple songs, poems. I've done interpretive dance as well.
I know.
All sorts of things. Like, I've behaved as an influenza virus, where the cell, the room that we're in is the cell, and I showed him how the virus attaches, the virus uncoats, the nucleic acid is then disseminated into the room, and the nucleic acid can then be copied and multiplied and so on. And I suppose these are little communication tricks or communication styles that I have that settle the class, that make the class feel, first of all, they enjoy it. And secondly, they begin to say, well, actually, that's a really interesting way, as you just pointed out, it's a really interesting way of getting across quite an academic concept.
It broke down barriers for me and made it seem, oh yeah, that's accessible to me.
Yeah.
Now, they were my own fears, you know, I had fears about academia and all that kind of stuff, but you support that in your... I think you've got an amazing emotional intelligence to be able to do that.
Well, I feel a little bit overawed by that comment, because I've read books on emotional intelligence and I've tried to figure out what emotional intelligence is, but I don't claim to have any form of emotional intelligence. But I would say that I do like people, and when you have that capacity as an academic who ostensibly should be in his ivory tower working away, beavering away on his academic papers, I tend to like to get out and to actually communicate with people at their level and to understand the influences that are preventing them from actually excelling as an individual. For example, I had a student some years ago. I was in a lab just talking to some students, and then at the end I noticed there was somebody peering through the glass porthole in the door, and she was appearing to wait for me. So I opened the door and I said, "Hello, can I help you?" And she said, "Could I speak to you, Dr. Colleran, for a moment, please?" And I recognized her as a student who had not been present in the institute for quite some time. And I said, "Of course, let's go for coffee." And she revealed to me that she was homeless.
Wow.
And I, with all my qualifications and all my letters after my name and so on and so forth, and the prestige that goes with being a lecturer, you realize that, wait a minute, here we have somebody who's trying to achieve, and they've trusted me with this sensitive information that they're homeless. What's my choice? And when I meet a student, I sometimes say in my own mind, what's my choice? Will I walk away from this student? Will I pass them over to somebody else, or will I get involved? And in this particular case, I got involved. And my wife also helped me, because we had to get this student ready for interviews. She couldn't afford clothes for interviews. We had to get her an interview outfit and so on and so forth.
Jesus.
And we did all that, and we had help and support from my colleagues in the chaplaincy service here in the college and so on. And she got a job.
Wow.
And
that's fantastic.
She came back to college and she completed her program. And that to me meant more to me, whether she got a first class honors or a pass degree, it was irrelevant. What was relevant to me was she was on a journey. She had reached an impasse in her life and she had decided to reveal something quite personal and difficult and ask for help. And if any of your listeners are in a similar situation where they feel that they cannot ask for help, they have to realize that the barrier to them making progress is that attitude. I can't ask for help. You can ask for help. Now, don't all ask me for help.
No, but you can ask.
I'll be inundated. But it's really important that you do connect with somebody that is friendly, trustworthy, and competent, and seek help. And I've said it to people over and over again, because students have come to me from time to time with other issues, and I'm always grateful that students would reveal that they have difficulties, because I'm a signpost. If I can't help them, I know where they can get help. So I suppose as a lecturer, I've really enjoyed that communication with students, and although I do communicate in a rather gregarious and sometimes humorous way in the lecture hall, that is only to get students to engage with me, and I have to engage at their level, and that's my modus operandi, if you like.
That's the first port of call when you're going to be empathetic. You know, you have to get down and meet somebody on the level, get into the hole with them.
You do. You have to be empathetic, and like what people don't realize is that, you know, they look at somebody who has a doctorate or what have you. I wasn't born with a doctorate. I was an appalling second level student. I repeated the leaving certificate. I was an appalling first year student at university. And the person who influenced me, getting back to your original question, was a Professor Peter Smith at the University in Galway, microbiology department, Professor Peter Smith. And he gave a lecture. He was a very interesting kind of lecturer. He brought his own beagle dog into the lecture hall at the time. He used to wear sheepskin coats, or Afghan coats, I think they were called at the time. He wore a leather hat, and he had a fulsome beard. And he was interesting. He was captivating because he had charisma. And I didn't attend very many lectures. I was lucky to attend that lecture at the time because that lecture changed my life. And I mean that sincerely. It altered the course of the rest of my life. He gave 1 hour on the subject of microbiology, and I realized microbiology was where I wanted to be. I was no good at physics. I was no good at chemistry. I was sparingly good at zoology. And I realized I really had a captivating interest in microbiology. I went on then into second year to be lectured in the subject microbiology. And I achieved first place in my class in second year, much to my surprise. Mm-hmm. And I achieved first place in my class in third year. And I was going for first place in my class in fourth year, but I didn't achieve it. I came third in the class that year.
Wow.
And a lot of people were kind of saying, oh, he didn't make it, you know, this is, must be the end of his career, and so on and so forth. And it wasn't. But what it did make me realize is that you don't always have to be first in order to be what you want to be. You know, I was devastated I didn't get first at the time. But I realized that you don't always have to be first in order to get where you want to be. And the seed of inspiration came from that individual. And that and from that, I realized that my privileged position as a lecturer allows me to be the seed of inspiration for others who are in my presence, whether they're in a class or in a at a coffee table or what have you, you know. So I suppose that those are the sort of early influences in my career as such.
Do you say that you have to be affected to have effect? And it's kind of what you said, you know, you've had some failures in your life and you know what it's like to find it difficult. And I am similar. I failed my leaving cert and, you know, right up to 33. And yeah, and I can so really connect with that.
It's And that's why I really appreciate, you know, working with people who have diverse histories. They're not all 600 pointers from the CAO. You know, there are some people, you know, who did really well in school, were really bad socially. Some were really social, very socially fantastic people, but really bad academically. So you're mixing with all these types of people in your as a lecturer. And what you're trying to get them all is to, wait a minute, let's all be quiet for a moment. Why are we studying this subject?
Right.
Why are you listening to me? And what is it about the subject that makes you excited? And it differs with different people. Like, some people are interested in disease, some people are interested in the immune system, some people are just interested in health, and other people didn't know why they were actually listening to me because it was on the timetable. But then later, because of some revelation within the class, they would find that they were really interested in antibiotic resistance. They were really interested in superbugs. They're really interested in what's happening in hospitals. Really interested in this business of vaccination. So I was realizing that I could turn on their interest to something they were completely oblivious to beforehand. And that's also very exciting.
Yeah. I remember leaving most of your lectures really thrilled, excited, delighted, really motivated, but then scared to touch a door handle, scared to actually even talk to another human being.
Yeah, well, and that's probably my naivety, I suppose. I get overzealous about communicating the topic. I fail sometimes to realize that it can engender anxiety in people. And so more recently, I tend to try to put everything into perspective. You know, while I say, yes, MRSA is out there, and yes, we have superbugs out there, if we follow good hygienic practices and we're generally healthy and we know how to handle, you know, a situation when a superbug arises, and that we get the appropriate antibiotics for our treatment, and we use those antibiotics as prescribed, which is often what we don't do, we don't finish the antibiotic course, then we have quite a considerable chance that we won't succumb to these types of infections. We have to remember also that these types of infections are largely impacting individuals who have already got severe health maladies or infirmities. And so we have to be most mindful when we're helping somebody who has a diminished immune system, an elderly patient, somebody who's in hospital. We have to be very mindful as visitors or as family members in how we can behave around that individual so that we don't contribute to infection. And that's really important. Education about aseptic practice, the avoidance of sepsis, is something that should be taught in secondary schools. I don't believe it should just be taught at third level, because these are pragmatic lessons in life. We all have to care for sick individuals in our own homes or in our own lives. We're all going to be sick at some stage in our own lives. So we need to be a bit more knowledgeable about microorganisms, but not be fearful, not be overly anxious.
Great point. How does your skill set then, the way you deliver lectures, the way you are as a person, how did that, I know you've spoken before about you delivering lectures in China, mm-hmm. how do you transfer that over there? Do you have that same kind of attitude, or is it just worldwide?
No, it's not common. I'm told it's not common. I don't attend lectures. I don't generally watch lecturers anymore because, I mean, I'm not a student. But I never saw that type of approach in my own lecturing experience as a student.
Right.
And I rarely see a lecturer who has, I suppose, who's not so self-aware that they don't mind to look foolish in front of a class in order to get a point across. And I think those who do, those more extravagant kind of lecturers, are lecturers who have, I suppose, been informed by an experience. And the most prominent one that springs to mind is I used to watch the Christmas lectures on television from the Royal Society in London. And they were lectures that were broadcast by the BBC, but they were lectures to young people, not necessarily third level students, but they managed to convey topics through different types of effects. They'd actually have, you know, demonstrations in the classroom. But the lecturers themselves had a unique style. And then if you look at Brian Cox, who's that magnificent Professor Brian Cox, who lectures in physics, he's on the television, I believe he's at the University of Manchester, and he has an entire show that travels the world based on his flamboyant but yet measured approach to the delivery of concepts in physics. He makes physics concepts, accessible to the public. And I'm influenced by people like David Attenborough because he uses his voice so well. And I do now broadcast a lot of my lectures. I do a lot of online lecturing. And so I have to also use those skills, those communication skills that I've witnessed and seen from other people. But I haven't been trained to do this. I mean, Institute of Technology or university lecturers are not trained to lecture. We are researchers who end up in front of a class. And it's quite daunting. So you have to improvise. And you
learn
have to,
on the job.
You learn on the job, but you don't learn from other individuals as such, because we don't get trained in group sessions as to how to lecture. And so I suppose this thing is I had innately developed because I suppose when I worked in industry, I was trying to work with operators to solve contamination problems. And so as a PhD academic who'd sequenced genomes and all sorts of stuff, that had no relevance to these operators. They wanted to figure out why the black spots were appearing in the bottle of product that they were filling in the filling line. And so you have to be able to, first of all, engage with them, get them excited about what you're talking about, and then work with them, get them to trust you. And communication style that I use engenders trust. First and foremost, it makes people feel comfortable. And so they felt more trusting. And then they listen. They listen to you and they listen to the message and so on. The other aspect of my communication is I don't just talk about what I'm doing. I physically show it as well. Like, so if I'm in the laboratory, I take a laboratory class, for example, with hospital workers every year, and they listen to me online for 10 lectures of microbiology. God bless them. I don't know how they do it. But then they come and meet me, and our laboratory is all about show and tell. So we get these people in. And the first thing I do is introduce myself in my normal way. And they feel at home after a while. And then I tell them the first thing, I don't want you to wash your hands. And they're quite confused. This microbiology, he's telling us not to wash our hands. And I say, now, surprise, surprise, everybody, you're going to have to put your hands into these agar plates. So what I'm doing is I'm getting them, before they actually participate in the lab, to first of all survey their own fingernails for what's on them. And we reveal then in the subsequent days that follow what percentage of the class actually are carrying different types of microorganisms on their fingertips. And that is something that, I know it's simple, but it's something that awakens their interest. They realize they're on the spot, that this lab isn't just about microbiology and sterile stuff, it's about me as a person. And I'm a healthcare worker, and I'm going into a hospital, and I could potentially be carrying microorganisms. And this is what my lab is all about. My microbiology lab is about you, the participant. What role do you play as a healthcare worker in preventing infection? So we then move from the hands, we take their personal items, their handbags, their mobile phones, their wallets. Jesus. We survey those. We survey them for different types of bugs. And then we move on and we talk about the air, and we survey the air, and we talk about the water system in the hospital, and we take samples of that and surfaces. And you'd expect water, air, and surfaces to be sampled, but you wouldn't expect the participants' personal belongings to be sampled. And they are. And the students have come back to me time and time again and said, that was the most revealing practical in microbiology or experimental laboratory experience I've ever had. And
that sounds fascinating.
It is so simple, and yet it is so revealing.
Yeah.
Because whatever we talk about microbiology in the abstract concept, microbiology isn't about microbes. It's about how human beings control the microbiological world around us. Because particularly in the healthcare context, we have to control the microbiological world around us. And that can only be brought about by increasing awareness.
Wow, it brings it back to the person, doesn't it?
It's not about,
oh, that bug over there, it's his fault. Yeah. It's you are the contributor.
So the so-called superbug, the MRSA, or whatever you might want to call it, it didn't arrive in the patient primarily just from out of the blue. There was some means of transfer. It was either in the patient's body to begin with over years as a result of taking antibiotics. They developed a population of bugs that were resistant to antibiotics in their own body. Or else it was transferred from other sources. And that's why we as individuals have to be very mindful of how we are around people who are already sick.
We might as well stay on this now while we're here. I was going to ask you later on about that. In the hospital that I work in, the National Rehab, it's all about the MRSA, the CPE, the superbugs. How bad is it? Is it getting really bad? Is it bad already? Or are we heading towards an epidemic? Because there's alarm bells going off everywhere. Okay. I go.
Your question implies, please frighten me. I wouldn't sensationalize it at all. What I would say is that we're living now in the post-antibiotic era almost. You know, antibiotics are, if they work, and they do work still, thankfully, in many cases, that's great. But in some cases, we find that antibiotics are not working. And we have a number of hospitals in this country that have had isolates of CPE or MRSA or what have you, C. diff. And the government have called a national emergency on antibiotic resistance. So to answer your question, the government has called an antibiotic emergency, if you like. But that doesn't mean that we have to run about and, you know, be terrified. It's a call to action, in actual fact. It's a call to action by professionals, both microbiologists, clinicians, and healthcare workers, to make themselves more aware of how these microorganisms are being transmitted and how to break the chain of transmission.
That's really important.
You know, we have been afflicted by infection since humanity was on the earth. We've always had infection, and there always will be infection. Antibiotics were developed in 1942 as a secret activity in Britain. And then eventually they moved from Britain with their development of penicillin to America. And it was produced in America for troops for the invasion of Sicily. And troops that were involved in the invasion of Sicily were the first to have antibiotics in their kit bag. And so antibiotics were only developed in the middle of the last century. And they now say that we're coming to an end in that era because we haven't developed sufficient new antibiotics. And wow. I disagree. We are still developing new antibiotics. We took a period of time where we didn't, where the world went into a sort of a period of, I suppose, they were more relaxed about the issue of antibiotics. I think one of the American presidents may have issued a statement in the 1970s to say that antibiotic or that infection was now something that was completely curable. And so companies didn't invest huge amounts of money into antibiotic development. And so there was a period of time where we didn't develop antibiotics, but the bugs were continuing to get resistant all through that period. I remember the first time I heard the word or the term MRSA was in 1985. And I was watching a program, a BBC program, and it was about a hospital in Australia and a burns unit. And I remember talking to Peter Smith, Professor Peter Smith at the time, about MRSA, and it was a little known microorganism on the horizon in the academic journals. And now it's exploded everywhere. And what that lesson has taught me is that we will always have microorganisms adapting to antibiotics. So we can never relent. We always must innovate and invent new chemical methods. Antibiotics are chemicals. So new chemical drugs to destroy microorganisms. We cannot let up on that. Okay. Interestingly, there are very few superbugs that are resistant to every antibiotic. And so that calls upon us also as professionals to make sure that when we do come across a super bug, that it goes to the lab and that the microbiologists survey that super bug for any sensitivity to any known antibiotic. Okay. So even though we say MRSA is a super bug, in many cases MRSA may be susceptible to one antibiotic or two antibiotics that we're just not using at the time. Okay. So it's really important.
Does it mean that it can't be developed?
Yeah,
going forward?
Or that it already exists. Oh, okay. I mean, I've had personal experience where someone I know had MRSA, and I asked the clinician at the time, who was a consultant microbiologist, to send it to the laboratory and have it surveyed for sensitivity. So they found out it was sensitive to tetracycline, which already isn't a drug that's in the cabinet for years. It's in the medical cabinet for years. Wow. But it wasn't being used on this patient. And so the consultant said, okay, so we'll deploy this. We had to get permission from the patient, first of all, to do this. But once they got permission, they surveyed the microorganism for tetracycline sensitivity, and then they used tetracycline to eradicate MRSA. So the message is that not all superbugs are resistant to everything.
Yeah.
There are sometimes individual antibiotics in the medical cabinet that they are sensitive to, in other words, that will kill them, but the hospital is not aware of this. So we need to have greater surveillance on these isolates from hospitals to see if there's any sensitivities.
Yeah. So what I'm taking from this also as well is, yeah, we can focus on the bug and focus on the letters MRSA, but we can really make more action from our behaviours, changing what we do, changing our practices, changing how we operate in the hospital as human beings, instead of getting focused down, oh, it's the MRA's fault, it's their fault. But we could actually do a lot of prevention way before that.
We can, and we are. I mean, the hospitals have introduced incredibly successful hand hygiene protocols.
Yeah, we've got a lot in the hospital.
And as well. They're very effective. And in fact, the rates of MRSA are diminishing.
Brilliant.
Which is really interesting. CPE, carbapenem, carbapenemase producing enterobacteria, which is a very long word, I suppose. They're basically bowel organisms. They exist in the bowel of many people. We don't know they're there until we get sick. Mm. And these microorganisms are becoming more dominant now. And if there's one thing that I've learned from working with sewage and as a microbiologist and working a lot with feces and other material like that, I know that these organisms are transmitted largely from sewers, from toilets, and so forth, from bedpans onto hands, and from hands onto surfaces. So again, we have to be very rigorous around our control of hygiene, particularly in the bathrooms, the bedpan washers, the bedpans, and in the drain pipes, the U-bends in the sink drains. We also need to sanitize those, because anything that goes down the sink, we think it's gone forever.
Yeah, yeah.
Not so. The microbes can stick to the actual pipes. Wow. And they can make their way back into the sink bowl. And we need to be very mindful of that we need improved hygiene around drains, U-bends, and so on if we're going to combat CPE and CRE. It's also present in people who come across the threshold of the door into the hospital. They bring it with them.
Yeah.
But having said that, we can screen people for the presence of these, and then we can place them into areas of the hospital where they're all together. They're not spread out across the hospital.
Gotcha. Wow. There you go. So we don't need to panic, yeah?
No, no panic at all. I mean, we approach it scientifically and logically, and we can overcome these as we have overcome many other ravages of microbiology down through the years.
I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to sleep tonight. I feel a lot better.
There's certainly no need to panic. No, no.
Brilliant. Just something I listened to on the radio on my way in, and you said this to me in 2011 about the HPV vaccination. They're now talking about giving that to males. What's your thoughts on that?
Oh, well, the HPV vaccination is a fantastic innovation in recent years. It was developed by a professor in Australia, and it was then marketed or developed commercially in partnership with pharmaceutical companies. And it has been deployed to females, particularly females in the teenage years, and very successfully it has reduced the rates of cervical infection by the HPV virus in the last decade. So we're seeing a huge diminishment amongst the vaccinated group in the emergence of cervical infection. And cervical infection is what leads primarily to cervical cancer. It's not that everybody who gets a cervix infected by a HPV virus is going to develop cancer, but it is a significant risk factor. So if we can reduce the infection of the cervix by the virus, we can then reduce the incidence of cancer. That's what we're seeing. Now, the sexual act involves male and female. So it may be male on male in a homosexual relationship, or in a heterosexual relationship, it may be male on female, or indeed in a homosexual relationship, you can also have, obviously, female on female. So what people don't realize is that this virus is no discriminator as to gender. The virus is a particle. It is not aware of what or who it's infecting. It's simply infecting cells that line the epithelium. In other words, cells of the genitals, cells of the anus or the rectum, that area, or indeed cells of the mouth or the throat. So it is going to infect those surface cells regardless of the sexuality, the sexual orientation, and what have you. So if we are truly to diminish the rates of infection by HPV, we cannot simply corral it to the vaccination of females. In my view, the vaccination of all sexually active people before they engage in sexual activity, because if they're already sexually active, they may have already been infected. So what we're trying to do is, as scientists, urge that non-sexually active individuals, so in their early teens, get vaccinated. And that includes boys, because they will eventually grow to be men. And if they're vaccinated, it's very unlikely that they will be infected, and they're very unlikely that they will transmit infection. So it makes perfect sense.
Why have they not been given to them to this date? Why has that not happened then?
As with all medicines, they're costly to produce, and particularly the HPV vaccine is quite an intricate vaccine in its production methodology. It's an expensive vaccine. So cost is part of it, and it's a reality. In the modern age, that vaccines cost considerable amounts of money. And in fact, there are only so many vaccines. There's a quantum of vaccines being produced annually. So we say, well, what's the best way to deploy these vaccines? Should we first deploy them to females? And the answer to that is yes, because it's not only females who get infected, it's not only females who suffer cervical diseases or diseases, or cancer, I should say. It's only females who suffer cervical diseases, of course. Mm. But men can also develop cancers from the HPV virus. For example, in the gay community, there is a considerable amount of anal cancer, and a lot of that is produced as a result of HPV infection.
Wow.
Yes, so
I never knew that.
Yeah, it's really important that people realize that the HPV virus doesn't discriminate against gender, but when we have a resource that we have called a vaccine, we have to say to ourselves as a society, where is it best to deploy this resource? And the most at-risk group at the time when they developed it first, they said, was females, and we want to reduce the rates of cervical cancer. And
okay.
And that's why. But now, with greater awareness, we now are beginning to realize we also need to reduce the rates of cancers in the male population as well. And men and women, obviously in heterosexual relationships, are involved in the transmission. So if we want to break the chain of transmission, we can't just focus on one of the sexual partners. We have to look at both of the potential sexual partners.
Wow, that's just a blow me mind. Jesus. It just seems we're on virus and we're talking about homosexuality. Now, I was listening to an interview by a guy called Tony Walsh. He's an activist for the Queer Archives. And he talks about PrEP. What's your thoughts on that? PrEP is a PrEP.
I don't understand what PrEP is. I'm sorry.
It's PrEP. It's prevention of somebody catching HIV.
Okay.
You can take it. So if your partner has HIV, you take PrEP and it prevents you from getting it?
Oh, I have no knowledge of...
Or PEP. Is it PEP or PrEP?
I have no knowledge of what that is at all. In fact, no. I've never heard the term before.
It's a drug that you take. It prevents you from catching HIV or whatever if they have it. If you take needles or you have homosexual sex.
Yeah, well, I don't know of any drug that does that, to be quite honest. My attitude towards HIV prevention is people should be screened for the presence of HIV in their bodies, and if they are HIV positive, that they should be following their medical practitioner's recommendations as to how to avoid infection, so safe sex practices and so on. But anyone who's on medication for the treatment of HIV, who is HIV positive, the medication is such that it diminishes the amount of virus present in their body and in their body fluids, but it doesn't eradicate the potential for them to be infectious entirely. So, you know, we need to be mature and mindful of the fact that there is no, in my view, there's no single drug that will totally eradicate the risk of transmission of
HIV. Something like 90% or something like that.
Yeah, but there is always associated risk associated with sexual activity of any kind, be it heterosexual or homosexual, in the transmission of microorganisms during the sexual act. The information that you provided me with here about PrEP or PEP, it's not something that I'm aware of, but I'm not aware of any drug that can prevent or totally eradicate the likelihood of transmission of any sexually transmitted disease. In fact, the only thing that prevents the transmission of sexually transmitted disease is no sex.
I was going to say that.
Yeah, so it's an interesting concept that you're bringing to my attention, because there's a lot of information and misinformation in the public domain about disease and microbiology, and it kind of underlines the importance of people must understand what these microorganisms do, where they hang out, how you control them, how you prevent them being transmitted, and the best source of that information is your medical practitioner and your educators, you know, people who are in the microbiological field.
As I found it fascinating when I heard about it, I thought, wow, that's brilliant to, you know, save a lot of lives. But then there was also a part of me where people would probably be a bit more promiscuous and it would give them a license to do act in an
unsafe way. Yeah. And that's true. I mean, with these types of anecdotal stories that you hear of in the media or in the social media or what have you, always have a little bit of a suspicion, especially if it's not coming from a medical source, that it may not be accurate. And that information is not accurate, in my view. It's certainly not accurate. I wouldn't want people to consider that if they have an infection such as HIV or indeed hepatitis or another infection, there's always a risk, regardless of what medicine that you're taking, that you can potentially transmit it. And always talk to your medical practitioner in confidence about the practices that you should engage in or should not engage in if you have such a transmissible infectious disease.
Cool. Absolutely brilliant. Right. I deliver a module called Healthy Living in the Hospital. And one of the trainees or the patients brought it to me about CBD oil. You know, he was like, they're always looking for a cure to fix something, whether it's memory or their information process. And he's like, what do you know about CBD oil? And I don't know a lot about it, but I was reading about it, the endocannabinoid system. So he says to me, I told him I was coming over here to talk to you, and he says, ask him what does he think about, what's his thoughts of the endocannabinoid system. What are your thoughts on it?
In fact, again, as a microbiologist, I'm not a neurologist. I'm not somebody who knows anything about the endocannabinoid system, as you call it. I don't understand what CBD oil is. Okay. I'm aware that it's sold, but I don't actually know what its pharmacological effects are. Yeah. If it's sold, it's obviously legal. It must be legal, but it's derived from the cannabis plant, I believe.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of medicinal uses for cannabis.
I didn't know that the endocannabinoid system was one of the biggest systems in the body. You know, we have receptors on the nucleus, and I read loads after he said it, and I asked a guy that sells it to come and do an interview with me, but yeah. Twice he's turned me down because I told him I want to know what happens at a cellular level.
Actually, I don't know, in fairness, Matt, I don't know anything about the endocannabinoid system, as I say. But what I would say to people is that if they do have underlying medical conditions, the source of information, again, is a medical practitioner. It's not social media. It's not hearsay.
Or internet sheriffs.
And it's not marketing. Not companies that are marketing some newfangled oil, you know, to solve all their problems. It's really important that you talk to your medical practitioner, and they will be able to explain the potential effects, benefits, or otherwise of any medicine, be it prescribed over the counter or an over the counter medicine. I don't know if CBD oil is actually considered a medicine or if it's considered a treatment for anything. I am aware that it's marketed in health stores around the country, but I don't. Other than that, I don't have any.
I'm very skeptical about it.
Yeah, I don't have any desire to investigate it further myself. Because
me too.
It's not something that I feel is. I think it's muddying the waters for people who have issues like chronic pain or issues with anxiety or depression.
It sells all that. It's the golden key to that.
Yeah, so I mean, everybody has frailties and vulnerabilities. We're all subject to the ravages of, I suppose, pressures of work, stress, and life, and so on. So we're going to reach out to whatever is being marketed to us, but be cautious, because we might be parting with our hard-earned euros for something that is nothing more than a contrived article. I don't know of any benefits. I've never researched it.
Yeah, nor had I, and it was never on my radar. And I said to myself, why do I not know about this? And then when I get into it, it's going, this is why, because I'm not so comfortable with it. It didn't really stand out to me that it was a benefit, because I looked on how it affects the homeostatic system, you know, rebalances homeostatic process. And I was just,
here again, what we see and what I can see from talking to you is that there's a lot of large words, a lot of complicated scientific-sounding words that are being used to sell this product. And the public don't know really what the product is, and they're putting their trust in some marketing literature that they read on the internet or wherever. Don't do that. I mean, if you have a problem, talk in confidence to your medical practitioner. And if you don't particularly have a good relationship with that medical practitioner, go and find another medical practitioner and talk about your problems, particularly problems around areas anxiety, depression, and neurological difficulties. Don't put your trust in what I would call snake oil.
It's snake oil, stuff
that, you know, is sold by, you know, we have a history in society that people trying to sell elixirs of all sorts of potions and
roll
lotions.
Roll up.
And this is probably another one of those fads.
I rang him twice. And I spoke to him and I told him, I said, look, I have a background in science, and a little bit. And I said, but I don't want you to come on like Del Boy and start telling me prices and quantities.
So I need
to know where to sell your level, what's going down. And the snake oil seller never came back to me.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, you can read and I can read about things, but, you need to research information considerably, and you need to trust information sources, reputable information sources. Are they qualified? Are they competent? Are they just salespeople? You know, because all too often, as humans, we are completely sucked in by sales talk. And we don't necessarily have this recourse to libraries like I do, or you don't have recourse to professional chemists and pharmacologists like I do. I can certainly talk to my colleagues about it and find out more, but I don't particularly think the general public should trust information like that. You know, they should really trust in their medical practitioners to try and help them to overcome the difficulties, and not trust in marketeers.
Yeah, people just think, oh, but it might just work, you know, that golden chance, and if it works it'd be in the mainstream.
But then there's adverse effects with every medicine, no doubt there's adverse effects with CBD oil, as you say, or whatever oil it is. Every product potentially that has a healthcare benefit may have an adverse effect in some people. And that's something that people aren't aware of. You know, there's there's no magic bullet out there that is totally not, has no side effects.
And there's anything I do, whether it's weight loss or whether it's putting on muscle or whatever, there's never a one fix cure.
Exactly.
It's an accumulative effect.
Yeah.
And have all your ducks in a row.
Absolutely.
And like if you have a process of OEB, anxiety, or depression, it wasn't caused by one thing. It wasn't caused by a deficiency in cannabinoids.
Absolutely. There are multifactorial things like depression, anxiety has many influences. It could be historical effects of, you know, in childhood that don't manifest again until adulthood. There could be issues around abuse or dependency that are also contributing to depression. I mean, this notion, and it's interesting you bring up CBD oil, because the notion amongst young people that, you know, smoking and cannabis and so on is cool and has no side effects other than, you know, you get high or what have you. It's totally fake news, if we want to use that kind of language.
Fake news.
Cannabis has a huge detrimental effect on young people in particular, but on all people who use it. And they don't realize it's not just simply the chemical dependency effect. There is it's a pathway drug towards mental illness. It causes psychological disorders. And I know people will listen, and some people who may use this drug in their own lives, but these drugs have a hugely detrimental effect on the psychological well-being of the user.
I have seen firsthand, personally, people that has affected psychotically.
Yes.
I've seen it professionally.
Yes.
Brain injuries, their brain injury has been secondary to psychotic episodes, as in trying to die by suicide, end up with hypoxic injuries, down to misuse of cannabis.
Yes.
Now, I'm not blaming that
and,
again.
And you know, some people regard cannabis as it's not as bad as heroin or it's not as bad as cocaine.
Drug's a drug.
It is bad. It's pharmacologically active in the brain, and it causes alteration to mood, and it can cause alteration to brain activity. So it affects intellect. It affects your IQ. It can affect your vascular system. People will dispense with that and say, well, I use it for stress relief. Go to your medical practitioner if you are stressed.
It's a toxin. It's a toxin. That comes into the body will change at a cellular level chemically.
It is a toxin, and it accumulates in the body fat. So it is, you know, the more you smoke it, the more accumulated it becomes. And you can become quite dependent, as with nicotine, in fact. You become quite dependent on it. It has, I've seen it in wider society, having spoken to so many students over the years, that those who do use these types of drugs end up almost invariably with depressive episodes. And they find that they become anxious, they become paranoid, and it can lead to chronic problems in that vein, like chronic problems of psychological nature.
Yeah, and it's sold because it's healthy and it's a plant-based, but I mean, the manufacturing of it is...
Oh, you're talking about CBD oil, is it?
I'm talking about just cannabis.
Oh, cannabis,
you know, even
that
in itself is claimed to be, it's from a plant, it's good for you, and
it's
rubbish.
No, it's total
nonsense. I don't buy into it. I've never smoked it.
But I think it would be useful. I mean, from broadcast organizations, and in fairness, broadcast organizations have tried in the past, and I think maybe there needs to be a resurgence of discussion in the public domain about the adverse effects of cannabis, especially so that young people know about the adverse effects, the damaging. And I'm not talking about the damage to the lungs, or, you know, the fact that, you know, it causes paleness in the pallor or what have you. I'm talking about the long-term psychological effects and the effects on their intellectual capacity. Cannabis can lower the IQ. Cannabis use can lower your intellectual capacity, and people don't realize that. I know one student who was brilliant, not from this institute, from another university in my heyday when I was a student, and he was a brilliant student. Second year in secondary school, he was A's in every subject. He went into university and he studied a particular subject that involved a lot of mathematics, and he couldn't get out of second year. He started smoking cannabis in first year, and in second year he was failing all the time. And eventually he left the college after 6 years or 5 years.
Wow.
And this individual was so talented. He could have reached the heights, dizzy heights of an academic career. And I don't know what he's doing now, but that was my first introduction, I suppose, as a young person, as to the detrimental effects of cannabis on people. It, it's just a devastating drug. And I wish the broadcast media, print and television and radio, would alert people more to the dangers of it, because we don't tend to. We talk about the drug dealers, we talk about we talk about the loss of life as a result of people who can't pay their drug debt. We talk about the psychotic episodes in the house where people are thrown out of the house and they end up homeless. But we don't actually go into our secondary schools in a major way and start to reveal the damage that cannabis does at a human level on mental capacity and on behavior, of course, but on mental capacity as well.
Wow. Wow, that Jesus is really brilliant. Brilliant. Seems we're on mental capacity, and I've covered diabetes with you, type 2 diabetes.
That's right.
They're talking about Alzheimer's being type 2 diabetes 3. Have you any thoughts on that? Or
no, I wouldn't agree that Alzheimer's is type 3 diabetes.
I've
as
heard
such.
That being called.
Alzheimer's, from my understanding of Alzheimer's, is that it's a gradual disintegration, I suppose, of the capacity of cells in the brain to actually communicate effectively. And there are plaque proteins that are accumulated in the brain, and that can prevent, over time, that prevents normal neurological activity in the brain. We're not quite sure as to the causes of Alzheimer's. We know there's a genetic element, and that there can be hereditary factors. Whether diet or whether diabetes or sedentary activity can accelerate Alzheimer's, I don't read the research papers on Alzheimer's, but I imagine that the lifestyle, the modern lifestyle that is heavily inundated with sugars and sedentary lifestyle leading to obesity and smoking, cannot help the situation in terms of if you're predisposed to Alzheimer's illness in your family from a hereditary point of view, I would say a sedentary lifestyle, an obese lifestyle, and having type 2 diabetes will only make it worse. It'll probably accelerate it. But the actual causes of Alzheimer's I'm not aware of, because it's not my particular area as such.
A lot of low-carb advocates would say that, you know, high sugars and leads on to Alzheimer's and all that.
Yeah. Like a high sugar diet can lead to, you know, more problems than we were aware of, because sugar itself is, you know, in a high level, it can cause type 2 diabetes, and that in itself can contribute towards cardiovascular disease, which can contribute to neurological disease in the brain, because if your blood system in your brain is affected because of type 2 diabetes, dementia can ensue, because if you have restricted blood flow, or if you have TIAs, transient ischemic events, they're like small mini strokes. They can happen. They're more prominent in people with type 2 diabetes at the advanced stage of type 2 diabetes. So we do see dementia occurring in the cohort of the population that's elderly that has type 2 diabetes. Yeah.
Wow. Fascinating. What are you working on at the moment, other than your lectures going to Holland and all, but what else are you active at the moment?
Yeah, well, I'm not research active at the moment. I was research active some years ago, but I haven't been engaged in research for quite a long time. So most of my work is spent liaising with healthcare professionals, hospitals and primary care centres. And what we're doing is we're developing training programs or education programs for people who are working in the health service. And primarily our work is to help to educate them on the science behind disease transmission or infectious transmission. Many of the people that I work with would work in surgical instrument decontamination or endoscope decontamination. And these are medical instruments that are used repeatedly over and over and over again on patients all throughout the year. And so these instruments, they're reused, and therefore they need to be cleaned, disinfected and sterilized, and handled it aseptically, handled in a sterile way, so that the microorganisms that may be present on one patient don't end up getting transmitted to a subsequent patient. So that's the kind of education that I'm involved in now. I'm involved primarily in training people in the workplace, not in the institute. So these people, I educate them online, by deliver lectures online, and then they go on to get a certificate qualification. And they can then become trainers in their own workplace, and they can train new people coming in to show them exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it, explain the science behind it. It's an initiative that was pioneered by the HSE some years ago with the Institute, and it has been running now, I think, for 3 or maybe 4 years, and it has been quite successful. We have about 200 healthcare workers who've gone through the program, and another 100 are going to start on the program now in the next number of weeks here in the college, online, of course. So that's what I'm working on, I suppose, most of the time. And what I was working on some years ago is I was delivering lectures in China as part of the pharmaceutical science program here in the college. It's something I want to get back to. I haven't been out to China since 2011, and I have a great relationship with the people in China. And what we also need to be mindful of the fact that Chinese companies are coming to Ireland. And there's a major Chinese pharmaceutical company. It's setting up in Dundalk. And by having academics who have that understanding of the Chinese education system and the Irish education system, that can really help to embolden the status of the country to the Chinese pharmaceutical manufacturing base. And I would hope to see far more pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies coming to Ireland from China. That's something that I'm really, really interested in, and it's something I want to get back
to. Sounds exciting.
It is exciting. Ireland has enjoyed an incredible reputation amongst the medical device and pharmaceutical base in the United States. And we have a lot of United States companies here in Ireland at the moment. But what we've been doing with them, we can now do with companies from other parts of the world who want to base in Ireland for access to the European Union. And it's an opportunity, I suppose, for Ireland. It's an opportunity for educators as well to get involved in promoting education in these technical science education areas with pharmaceutical companies in China. And that's something that I want to continue to do.
Savage. I'm really conscious of the time. I could sit here all day listening to you and talking to you. What's the one thing you would like people to take from this interview?
Well, okay. I think it's important that people, first of all, if we go back to the very first beginnings of the interview, that people need to be preparing when they're going into the workplace, to be prepared, prepare their interview well, and to let their personality shine through. That's the first thing. The second thing is that if you're going to get anywhere in education, I think what you need to do is find or research or understand why you're studying a particular subject. Don't fall into a pattern of just going to college to study a subject because your friends are. Try to develop your own understanding of what you're interested in. Remember, second level is boring. Nobody ever said second level was going to be otherwise, I suppose. Third level doesn't have to be boring. Third level can be really exciting, but what I found in my own experience is that third level is exciting when you discover what you're interested in. And that largely doesn't happen in first year. It happens in the second year. So don't lose hope if you don't like your first year of a course, because there will be sort of nuggets, subjects within that first year course that you might be able to take on into other years and specialize. And the last thing that I'd like people to take from the interview is, don't trust science speak from any source other than scientists or medical practitioners. Don't trust hearsay, gossip, social media.
Bro science.
No bro science.
No gym rats. Don't listen to gym rats.
Don't do that. Always go to reputable sources of information. And if you are a parent and you're in, you know, you have vulnerable young people, as all young people are vulnerable, we have to be mindful that we talk to them about the devastating effects of drug use, not just simply the fact that it's socially unacceptable and you can get a criminal record and so on, but the devastating effects on their psychological well-being, because a lot of young people I've spoken to don't agree with me, and they don't think, they dismiss me when I say it. And I think it's important that we keep that message front and center as parents.
I'm going to ask you, would you come back on the show to talk about that stuff again then, maybe? Could I get you on again?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love
to talk about pharmacology with you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a pharmacologist. I'm a scientist. And I suppose, I mean, if you had a particular topic, Matt, that you wanted to talk in a bit more depth about, if you tell me what topic you want to talk about, okay. If I feel qualified and competent, because remember, don't listen to people who are not qualified in the field. That's important.
Yeah.
So it has to be somebody who's qualified and competent. Now, I don't mind participating in a program where there are colleagues who have the competency in pharmacology.
Right.
I mean, by all means, I would love to participate in your programs. There's no question about that. I think what you're doing, just as an educator, you were one of my students. I'm quite enthused and energized by seeing you here today doing what you're doing, because communication is so important if we're going to breach the gap between the general public and the science community. And it's only by having conversations like we're having here.
And that's what I want to bring.
Yeah,
and I want to break down those barriers and say, this is what's really happening. This
yeah,
is like,
and that's so important, because, you know, opportunities for scientists to talk to the public are few and far between. You know, there are very few science programs on radio or TV, for that matter. And when they are there, they're generally science programs about nature, unusual animals, or, you know, some sort of gee whiz effect. But, I mean, this is a genuine conversation about science and its impact, I suppose, on society. That's what you're doing. Mm. You're pioneering in this field. I know you interview all types of people.
But it's for that. It's Josie, you're just hitting the nail on the head.
Yeah.
It's the bridge of that gap. I can tap into a resource that would be beneficial for you as a human to educate you.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm just one sphere of education. Mm. I'm in the microbiological area. But there are many other colleagues who are scientists and other academics who may also be interested in you know, participating on podcasts.
Sounds brilliant.
To the general public.
I'd love it.
But, you know, the inspiration I get from you, seeing you now and seeing all the equipment you have in front of you and so on, it's amazing. I'm just delighted that you have taken this upon yourself to, you know, to become a broadcaster, and I think it's a really noble and honourable thing to do. It's exciting.
Thanks very much.
And I'd like to compliment you on that.
You're a legend. Okay, so we leave it there. Dr. Ger Colran, I'm absolutely blown away by your generosity, you as a human being, you as an educator, you as an inspiration. And I don't blow smoke up people's backside. I just don't interview people I've no interest in. You, but you have a huge impact on me, and I thank you very much. And thanks for coming on the show.
Not at all, and be delighted to come on the show again.
Okay, so there you go. That wraps up another absolutely amazing podcast. Absolutely amazing. I'm sorry to all my other guests, but that's possibly my favourite guest ever. From the time I decided to do podcasts, I've always wanted Dr. Ger Colran on, because he's somebody that I spent some time with, and he had a huge impact on my life as somebody in education. I went back to education as a mature student, and for to have a lecture, somebody like that, and deliver a subject that I felt was so complicated in such a cartoony way, but yet still hold that professionalism, it just blew me away on so many levels. And I just wanted to meet back up with him again, to tap into that, and then also his professionalism, you know, as a microbiologist. I thought he was an immunologist. I'm such a tit. How did I get that wrong? But first and foremost, I wanted to meet him as an educator and, you know, talk to him around that, because he has shaped the way I deliver education. I deliver education in the National Rehab, and I use those kind of same skills. You know, I bring humour to subjects that I deliver, you know. And it works, you know, and again, I think he has amazing emotional intelligence to understand his audience, to empathise, to get down on that level. You know, I went to a lecture with Eva Doherty, a doctor in psychology in the National Rehab, and she talks about emotional intelligence, and I hope to have her on the show in a couple of weeks. She's agreed to come on, and I'd love to tap into that. You know, I know Dr. Ger Colran says that he doesn't have that. That's my perception. That's what I see. Like, that's what I call emotional intelligence. You know, and he has that. And he was able to break down those barriers for me as a student. And I know from the class, I was the class rep. I know speaking to them, loads of them. And it's still to this day, people remember him. Like, people just say, Jesus, he was sound, you know, to deliver such a subject. But make it accessible. I had huge difficulties with return to education. I went from leisure management. I went back to education at 33. You know, I'd failed my leaving cert. So I'd done a leisure management, and that was personal training there. And I could get away because I was a bit of a gym rat, gym bro science, couldn't do it, as we talked about in that interview. But going on to, you know, an academic course such as a sports science, I was so insecure, so nervous, so anxious. Like, I didn't even know what the power of something in maths, you know, or greater than sign when it came to maths. And I really struggled. And it was the likes of Ger Colleran and a couple of other lecturers in the college that really had a big impact on me, that really helped me. I know I've had my complaints about when I left the college, but that's not to say they were bad. That was just the place that I was in. But I left there, as he said, about other people having an impact on his life and changing the course. These people did. There's been some standout people in me that have changed the shape of my personal and professional career, like himself, you know, Kieran Collins, Michael Courtney. Oh yeah, Michael Courtney. This is an interesting one. I went up to the college to meet Ger Colleran. I was in the canteen and there's another lecturer that was there, Michael Courtney. He was my chemistry teacher in fourth year, and there was snow. And I think it was 2010. Yeah, 2010 we had bad snow and we were off the college. The college gave us some time off. And as I say, he was a chemistry teacher. And to be honest, I was absolutely struggling with chemistry because, as I say, I had failed my leaving. My maths knowledge was brutal. Chemistry is a huge part of maths. Again, and I had huge insecurities around my education. So there was lots of factorial things to take in. But he offered to me, myself, and a couple of students in Bewley's and Grafton Street. Like, I mean, what? That's well outside his job description. He didn't have to do that for us, but he did. He met us. I think it was about five or six of us were willing to walk in the snow into Bewley's and Grafton Street and gave us a tutorial on chemistry for about 2 hours. And we had coffee and, like, Jesus Christ, that's breaking down barriers. Like, that's making things accessible. That just blows my mind to this day for someone to do that. You know, that had a huge, huge impact on me and my course of true education, and that helped me so much. That really got me through that year, because chemistry is goddamn difficult at the best of times. So yeah, I bumped into him up in the college, and it turns out that he is actually best mates with Ger Colleran. Do you know what I mean? That old saying where we're the average of the five people we spend the most time with. There you have it, birds of a feather and all that. So he's mates with Ger Colleran. So yeah, it was brilliant to sit down and have the chats with him, and I reminded him actually of that time he'd done that for me, and I thanked him because it was fantastic. Like, I work in the HSE now. I'm not slagging anyone on my job, but there's some people that just shouldn't be in their jobs. The same as when I went to Talla, I had some lectures. I'm not giving out, but I'm just saying maybe there's a profession out there that they should have followed rather than teaching or delivering education, because it just wasn't their calling, and I could smell that off them. This wasn't their gig. The likes of Michael Courtney and Ger Colleran, like, this is their calling, to educate people, because they really care about humans. And you can hear that in the interview with Ger Colleran, looking out for that student that was homeless, and he helped them out. You know, he just left his letters after his names and his academia and all his professional, and done what any human would do, would try to help out. You know, it's just remarkable. It's just such a coincidence that these two lads our friends. So I was delighted to hear that, actually, and hopefully in the near future I could get Michael Courtney on. I'd love to have the chats room and get a bit of a background on his thoughts and experience in education. And so yeah, that was an amazing podcast, and I was talking to Ger Colleran after, and I'd love to get him back on. As I say, I'm a huge, huge nerd for science. I read loads, but I'm not qualified, and I just read loads and I don't give out free information, but I love sitting down and listening to it and talking about it. And like, even when I deliver stuff in the hospital, I say, this is what I've read, this is what I know, but please, 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 as Ger says, consult your medical practitioners. They know more than I do. I'm just well read on things, and I'm fascinated. But I don't give out advice. I just say, well, this is what I take or I don't take, but don't trust what I give you, because I'm not qualified in that area. I just love bringing awareness to people. I love bringing education. Did you know about this? Did you know about that? Maybe do some reading on it. Take your own education in your own hands, and then bring it to your medical practitioner, because they would know best. So yeah, we talked a little after the podcast, and I was just saying to him, I'd love to have you back on, and we're going to have a chat again on what topics that he would be interested in delivering, and I'll go off and I'll do some research and I'll bring back questions, and then we can bring education. As I had an absolute light bulb moment when he says about bridging that gap between science and the public. That's exactly what I love doing. I love making people aware of, did you know this? Go and explore more, because that is sometimes the problem. We lack the education. But I also found it's not just about the education, there's also the behavioural changes, but we can only do one step at a time. So yeah, I'd be absolutely buzzing to get him back on, because I just love spending time with people like that. That's exactly what I want to do with the show. He's up there as my favourite guest. Imelda May could probably top him if I can get her on, because she's a Liberties legend. But for right now, he's up there with the best. I'm still buzzing after, I listened back to it, to the interview when I was editing it, and I just was blown away. I just listened to it like it was the first time I've ever heard it. So yeah, I'm absolutely buzzing. As always, I'll always ask you to mind yourself, self-empathy, be kind to yourself. I'm not going to read you another one of those stories as I read last week, or the week before actually. Last week's one was the Suicide Talk Time show. I hope you really enjoyed that. I hope that you're minding yourself after that show. Again, look after yourself, look after your family, mind your own mental health. As I always say, if you're kind to yourself, you can be kind to your fellow human beings. As always, I'd like to thank Niall Riley from Rooney Media, my old mate Carolyn Harvey from ISA Nutrition. I will give you an update on my body composition change in the next week or two. That's really going well. We're 12 weeks into the cut. I'm getting leaner. She's been a huge help for me, for dropping my body fat. So I'll probably do another update on that one. So that's going really well. So if anybody is interested in weight loss or fat loss, building muscle, or just educating yourself around nutrition and a healthy lifestyle, check out ISA Nutrition. As always, I can't thank my team enough, especially for the show that they did last week, the Suicide Safe Talk, or the Suicide Talk Time. Amazing show. Sound editing by Kevin Doyle, and the media stuff where Aaron Kyoladges are absolute legends. I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of the job we've done on the Suicide Talk Time. We've really received really, really well. So well done, guys. As always, I'll ask you to keep subscribing on iTunes and leave a delicious review. We need your reviews. We need to get the positive vibes. I want nice reviews. Don't leave stinky ones. So leave a positive review for us. We're on all the podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, SoundCloud, iTunes, Anchor FM. So wherever one you listen to, please share it with your family and friends. Get the word out there, because we really need the word to spread it, because our shows are just getting better and better. And if there's anybody out there that you'd like us to interview, get in contact with me. Send me a message on Facebook or Twitter, or my email address, matt@magicminds.ie. We'd be delighted to interview people that have an interesting or educational story. We're all about inspiration and motivation and education here, you know. Stories that have the power to inspire. That's our logo, so we want to stick with that. So, as always, wherever you are in the world, look after yourself, be kind to you, and you'll be kind to the world. Take care. Bye-bye.